It seems to me you're drawing a picture of a situation which isn't just sort of anticipating the financialization of the art market, for example, in the next few decades. It's also the culmination of the mid-century institutionalization of the avant-garde, in which New York, I think plays a central role. I often say to
Absolutely,
students,
absolutely, yeah.
I often say to students that really, the category of modernism is sort of It's very, I mean, the key institution that sort of popularizes this as a category at all is MoMA, it's the Museum of Modern Art. Because in Paris, it's just not recognized. People don't recognize themselves
That's
as
right.
being called modernists. They see themselves as belonging to these various stylistic movements, which are more or less all more self-consciously politicized. And modernism, the invention of modernism as a category, is partly the sort of depoliticization of the avant-garde and the institutionalization of the avant-garde. And it all crystallizes around, I mean, it sort of crystallizes around these two key figures, which is Jackson Pollock, who is this sort of the invented figure, the CIA sponsored, like invented figure of the muscular American post-war modernist artist, and Picasso, who is sort of brought into the narrative because he looks the part so well. You leave out the fact that he was a communist and you just make him like the most valuable artist in the world. And so
He was too great to be ignored.
And yeah, and so, but this all, and it's indeed, so this sort of creates this context where to some extent, the sort of the success of the both state and corporate and philanthropic sponsorship of the arts and the avant-garde in the post-war period has created this sort of possibility for people that you can be like a great important, you can be an avant-garde artist, but also an absolutely establishment figure, a figure who'll appear on the cover of Time and Playboy, and that sort of, and the,
Absolutely right. And let me add, since you do mention state support there, that as many people have pointed out, the public funding of the arts beginning in the 1960s in the Kennedy administration was key to giving a large number of artists and musicians the financial capital to buy a loft or to buy a share of a loft building. In my interviews, artists have told me about how they had good friends working at the New York State level, New York City level, and federal level of the new arts agency, arts or arts agencies, who were happy to give them grants and turned a blind eye to their investing these grants in real estate. Maybe some of them even invested as landlords, but small scale investing, at least in their own real estate. I tend to think that non-white artists did not get many of those grants, which again would lead to their precarity in the downtown art world, because they'd be renters, not owners for the most part, and they might not even have the financial wherewithal to rent in a stable way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think also, I mean, we can definitely point to parallel processes with the institutionalization of jazz and the kind of fusion between the academic musical avant-garde and certain strands of jazz. I mean, it sort of makes me think about how, one of the iconic figures for us musically, I mean, not as a personality, but in terms of his musical output in the early 70s is Miles Davis. And my sense is always that I mean, what's sort of fascinating about Miles at this moment is that his complaints about the academicization of jazz and the avant-garde and its whiteness, they're often quite, it's sort of incoherently articulated, but there is this sense that he's looking for a way out of that moment. He's looking for a way sort of back to the street through punk, through funk, or back to back to what the youth are listening to, or back, a way back to the count through to the counterculture through these kind of psychedelic dimensions. And there is this sense of that. There's this sense of, and that's, I mean, he's an interesting pivotal figure just because he's part of that generation in the 50s who becomes sort of canonized as, as jazz becomes respectable and it becomes the music of the avant-garde.
What was he a graduate of Juilliard?
I think he spent some time there. Yeah, I think so.
Well, if so, he comes out of a prestigious university background, not university, a quasi-university background.
But I think that's also, I mean, also just more broadly, that also gives us a really interesting, I mean, it sort of confirms something we're always talking about in the show, the extent to which the kind of radical energy, the radical cultural energy at this time is coming out of those, it's coming from those social groups who haven't really been the full beneficiaries of that post-war settlement in the same way. It's coming from women, it's coming from people who experience themselves as sexual minorities, it's coming from people of colour. And I think it's a really helps clarify why that would be the case, like to understand the fact that it's all those groups who don't really, they don't get the grants in material, so they don't manage to benefit from the institutionalization of the avant-garde in the same way.
Well, that's true. The grants, MoMA, as you mentioned, you know, the lack of attention by museum curators, the lack of attention by art writers. I mean, in the 1970s, in the pre-internet age, there were several newspapers that featured art criticism. And there were newspapers that were produced for the general public, like the Village Voice, for the somewhat more rarefied local public, like the East Village Eye or Soho, eventually Soho Weekly News. And then there were papers or magazines or volumes, like the one produced by Walter Robinson and his partners, Dayok and the third partner, that were influential in the downtown art world, but were probably and were tremendous encyclopedias of art writing, you know, focused on on avant-garde artists, but they were not widely circulated, though, you know, media like that were not widely circulated.